This is Eleanor Swent continuing the interview with Frank Joklik in Salt Lake City, Utah on February 22, 1994. We might have missed just a speck there. You were telling about the Copper Club
Man of the Year dinner at the Waldorf in New York in 89. And I was saying that, you know, those are not awarded every year to just because someone's become CEO of a large copper producer or fabricator, but because it's felt that someone has really made a contribution to the industry. So I felt very humble for recognition of myself and the Cancod management team to receive that.
Now this beautiful statue is...
Yeah, the Rodin thinker, yes. And as I mentioned to you conversationally a few days ago when we were on our way back from the Olympics at Lillehammer, we stopped off in New York and I attended the dinner there at which 50 years of Copper Club were commemorated. That was the honoree this year, 50 years.
Mm.
And they showed some irreverent pictures of some of the recipients. I think two that Simon Strauss chose to show of me. One of them was in the course of a ski race up at Snowbird, where for once I am in reasonably the right position to take a gate the way it should be taken. And the other one was up at Fort Chimo up in Labrador all these years ago when we were going up to Ungava for field work, and I made friends with three Eskimos there, and Simon remarked that we had the makings of a bridge foursome, which evoked some mirth. And then shortly after that, in 89, when I was elected to the National Academy of Engineering, the nomination had originally come from Jim Boyd, for which I was
James Boyd did that,
very grateful, yes. And then Don Dahlstrom here at the University of Utah carried it through just after Jim died. The AIME, well, there were two honors there, the Saunders Gold Medal and then the SME Distinguished Member Award. And I think they both happened in 1991, 92. But one of the most memorable events was the Society for the Prevention of Blindness at their annual dinner here in 92 honored Pam and myself. And we had a great time preparing the video for that. I'd just come off a trip and I was totally jet-lagged. And, you know, sometimes when you're a little bit subconscious or unconscious there, you speak very freely. And I let slip a whole bunch of things which, again, were amusing to the people who saw the video afterwards. And it was all done in very good taste. There were testimonials from good senators, and in the preparation of the video, Ian McGregor participated, and Peter Grace, who's still a very good friend, and several local community leaders. It was, I was given the chance of seeing the video before it was presented, but I refused to do so. I really wanted it to be new when I saw it at the dinner.
I certainly enjoyed seeing it. It's a wonderful tribute.
Well,
to both of you.
A lot of fun. Yeah, exactly. Pam really, I think, was recognized at least as much as I was at that dinner, and that was very gratifying in view of the part she has played in the community here. Well, what else can I say? Another thing that tied us really to staying here was the very fact that we'd started building a house where we owned the building lot for 12 years without actually taking the bit between the teeth and going ahead with construction. So it was really completed just ahead of my retirement, but the whole move in and organizing the interior and so on still remained to be done. Beautiful. And we certainly weren't going to turn around and leave the place as soon as we'd soon as we'd finished it.
Very beautiful house.
Well, thanks very much, Lee. It's Pam's design, really, and if you want to give it a name, what did someone call it? Salt Lake Mediterranean.
Oh, right.
Something
okay.
like that.
Well, it's certainly lovely.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
As far as, activities for the future are concerned, there are several board commitments here for which the maintenance of this office that I have here is a great help. Bob Wilson wanted me to join the board of U.S. Borax, which you're very familiar with, Lee, because you've done the histories of several
people. It's a wonderful company.
Yeah, but as you know, it's undergoing change as it gets more exposed to the winds of change of international competition. That's a very interesting one. And then First Security is ongoing, and more recently, and I haven't attended a meeting yet, is Cleveland Cliffs, which I'm looking forward to. I think what caused them to call me was my Mount Newman experience, really.
Really?
Partly that I'm not looking forward to getting back into the international iron ore business a little bit there. The National Academy of Engineering has seen fit to put me on far more committees than I can handle, and there's a conference on management by the mining community of environmental responsibility. It's going to be an international conference lasting 1 week, and I'm supposed to chair the mining and oil parts of it. I'm not sure how I'm going to handle that yet.
And this is in Washington?
This is going to be actually in Los Angeles, because the Academy has a separate campus in Los Angeles, in Irvine, actually.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it'll be held there.
That should be very interesting.
And apart from that, you know, I've meant to keep my hand in exploration and natural and mineral resource development, but apart from examining a number of properties and companies, I haven't really got my act together on that yet. I've set up a little company that's been funded in a modest way, but that yet has to sort of get off the ground with its activities. It's called Westcliff Resources, which was, after prolonged soul searching, was really a name suggested by Pam, so I thought it sounded pretty good, so that's the name of it.
So this would keep your hand in on the exploration side.
Yeah, but you know, time is the problem. There's so much to do, and I haven't yet mentioned the Olympics, which
you must do
I could talk about just a little bit here.
I really wish we're resuming here on February 23rd, continuing and I think completing the interview with Frank Joklik. Pretty well covered the Kennicott career, and now we're starting the new career in the Olympics.
Well, as we concluded yesterday afternoon, time is not heavy on one's hands with the continuing activities related to the mining industry, various social commitments, but one that has been occupying, I would guess, maybe 25 to 30% of my time since my leaving Kennecott in June of last year, is the Olympics. And what I mean by that is Salt Lake's bid for the 2002 Olympic Winter Games.
How did you come to be involved with this?
Well, two things. One is my long-lived interest in sports, and particularly in winter sports, going way back. Let's see now, that was...
You've mentioned it.
It's going back about 40 years ago, mm-hmm. when...
You've mentioned your skiing throughout your adult life.
And I don't know whether I mentioned before, but I wasn't born with skis on, and
no.
I didn't learn to ski as a little kid either. It came about when I was at age, I don't know, must have been 25 or 26, out in Gaspé Peninsula, and contracted infectious hepatitis. And I was in hospital over there for a couple of weeks, and lost so much condition that in order to regain it, I had to do some physical exercise in the middle of winter, in the dead of winter there. It was January, and Gaspé can get pretty bitterly cold. And my friend from the local store, Buddy Hyman, gave me a pair of hickory skis, and I took those up and behind the little hill behind the hospital, and just went at it, making my own little piste and gradually learning to turn. And this was eventually reinforced when I went to Europe, and on a vacation to Austria, Christmas vacation, to spend time with my father. My mother had died the year before in 1956, and he staked me to a to 10-day skiing in the Vorarlberg region at Cirs, and I fell in the hands of a couple of pretty tough ski instructors there who weren't too lavish with praise, but ready to pick up any faults that they perceived. And it was pretty tough drill, but after 10 days I had pretty well mastered the technique, which is really the basis of modern skiing now. And we just kept on, and when Pam and I got married, she had she'd done very little, if any, skiing. Oh yes, actually she and her sister were going to go skiing at Kitzbühel, and I know how this came about. I think I had persuaded her that after we got married we'd go skiing in Austria, and then getting married took a little longer than expected, so she went there with her sister instead, and had a marvelous vacation without me. And so she got the rudiments of the sport, and we just never looked back from there. And even in Australia, when we went to Australia shortly after our wedding, and I opened the office for Amex there and became involved in Mount Newman, We even skied in the Australian Alps in Mount Kosciuszko, and I saw some of the biggest snow drifts there I've ever seen in my life. Plenty of snow, the terrain's not that steep, but certainly in a good winter you can get plenty of good skiing there. And then upon our return to North America, we continued, and it became a family sport. And all of our three kids all learned to ski when they were 4 or 5 years old, and enjoy it very much now, and it helps to still plan family vacations now at our little place at Snowbird, where I hope to go later today for a few hours.
Yes.
Here in Utah is, I think, the best snow in the country, because with the elevations we have here, the snow is reliable and it tends to remain dry. We don't get thawing and refreezing. And on a good powder day, when there have been 2 or 3 feet of new snow overnight, it's hard to duplicate such conditions anywhere.
And we have a perfect day today.
Well, one can't help noticing that, absolutely rightly, yes.
Well, we should comment on the beautiful view of the fresh snow on the mountains here, and you're itching to be out there on the slopes.
Yeah, there was a good dumper there last night, and it is kind of tempting to get out there and make full use of it. But Utah started to attract attention internationally as a major ski region when we had the first World Cup opening at Park City in March of 1985. This was organized by Nick Badami of BDV fame. Nick walked Park City some years previously, and he and his son Craig conceived the idea of attracting a World Cup event. That day in March we had the men's giant slalom, and it attracted all the big names at that time. Stenmark was still racing, and Ghirardelli, I think, won the giant slalom. But the memorable thing about it was a beautiful spring day. Snow conditions were excellent, and 13,000 spectators showed up, which, as Sergio Lang, who was Mr. World Cup skiing at that time, the driving force behind the World Cup. He was present, and in his remarks before the prize presentation, he said that this was the biggest crowd that they'd attracted to a World Cup event all season. So it was a very auspicious opening, and there have been World Cup events at Park City practically every year since then. Now, Salt Lake had bid for the Winter Olympics before then, and I'm not going to go through the history of that. I believe at one stage we lost to Sapporo, when Sapporo in Japan had the Winter Olympics, and then we lost, I believe it was in 85, to Anchorage as the potential site for the, maybe that was the 92 Olympics, which took place in Albertville. But I first got seriously involved in our bid for the 98 games. And when I say I got involved, two things. I joined the board of the bid committee, and I worked hard at fundraising for the bid campaign in the local community and with Kennecott's suppliers of equipment and materials. Our chances looked pretty good when the United States Olympic Committee made us the official candidate for 98 after competition with, I believe it was Denver and Squaw Valley and Lake Placid. Forget who else was vying for the honor of being the United States candidate. But we won that. And the decision by the IOC was scheduled to take place in Birmingham in June of 91. We received...
Is that Birmingham, England or Birmingham, Alabama?
Birmingham, England.
Okay.
Well, unfortunately, 6 months, or actually 9 months prior to that, we received bad news when Atlanta won the 1996 Olympic Summer Games in competition with Athens, Melbourne, Toronto were the principal candidates. But Athens was the favorite. And we happened to be in Greece when the IOC voted in favor of Atlanta. Of course, there was tremendous dismay amongst the population of Greece who thought they had it in the bag. Mm-hmm. But this was a mistake that cities had made before, where they assumed that they had it won, relaxed their efforts, displayed perhaps an arrogant attitude towards the International Olympic Committee, and then found when it came to the vote, they just didn't have the votes to win. We were happy for Atlanta, but the bad thing for us was that it was inconceivable that so shortly after Summer Games being awarded to the United States, that the Winter Games, mm-hmm. 9 months later, would also be awarded to the United States. And there was consideration of whether we should continue with our efforts for the 9 months remaining until the vote in Birmingham in June of 91. But we decided to plow right ahead because withdrawing, we felt, could give us a black eye, and that with the IOC, and that if we did so, they would hesitate to favor us for another crack at it for the following Olympiad in 2002. let me just explain for a second that this was the period during which the IOC voted to separate the Winter Games from the Summer Games. Traditionally, Winter and Summer Games had always been the same year, 4 years apart. And they decided to stagger the games so that every 2 years, Winter and Summer Games would alternate. Well, this brought about a breaking in stride of the four-year rhythm of the Winter Games, in that 1980 was Lake Placid, 84 was Sarajevo, 88 was Calgary, 92 was Albertville, but now there would be another Games 2 years later in 94 at Lillehammer, Norway. And Lillehammer had won, I believe, at an IOC vote in Tokyo in 88, I think it was, and to everybody's surprise, that little town in Norway won the Olympic Games in the face of very strong competition by the Swedes at Östersund, who were thought to have the inside track on that occasion, turned out not to. So we continued with our effort after the news about Atlanta, and in the winter of 1991, what I mean by that, from 1990 to 1991, we entertained here in Salt Lake City close to 60 of the 91 IOC members who came to visit us to inspect our facilities.
It must be enormously expensive in money and energy as well.
Both. Yes. Yeah. Absolutely, but that's what you have to do, because these people have to be given a chance to see what you've got, and it's no use inviting them en masse. They all have their schedules, and you have to receive them when they can afford the time to come and come and see.
So they might be here. They aren't here necessarily in the winter.
Not necessarily. Some come in the summer,
mm-hmm.
and you just have to tell them in the summertime what.
Try to imagine.
Show them the facilities and get them to imagine. Because of the 90, whatever it is, 91 to 93 IOC members, very few have had any experience in winter sports.
Sure.
The vast majority of them are people with backgrounds in summer sports.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them from a warm climate, and just all that anxious to come in the dead of winter here and wade around in masses of snow instead of come in the summer. Well, we had good fortune that winter. We had some massive snowfalls that coincided with the most important visits of these people. They had a site selection committee consisting of four IOC members and lots of IOC staff, and I think the day they arrived we had a 2 or 3 foot snowfall up in the mountains, and they were tremendously impressed by what they saw, at least that's what they told us.
Mm-hmm.
And then when President Samaranch paid us a visit later in the winter, I believe it was in March, we were out at the airport and had a brass band out there and everything to welcome him, and as he stepped off the plane it started to snow. It kept on for about 24 hours. And he had a good visit. But inevitably the June 15th deadline drew near. We were...
This was 90...
91. Yeah. And we we prepared to make a presentation there in Birmingham and to take a contingent of Salt Lakers over with us. This contingent in the end consisted of 250 people, all paying their own way, and their accommodation, their activities, their entertainment was all organized by Pam. She had the responsibility of doing that, and it was appropriate because of her background in Birmingham.
Yes.
She grew up there, so she mm-hmm. knew exactly where to go. We had some marvelous sort of one-day tours to the people, to some of the beautiful old homes and castles in the Cotswolds and other surrounding beauty spots. Birmingham itself isn't that exciting a city, but the surroundings are just wonderful. The presence of this contingent demonstrated to the IOC members the community support from Salt Lake City, and the presentation went as scheduled. The final presentations were made on June 15th. The other competing cities were Nagano, Japan, Hakka in Spain, Aosta in Italy, Östersund, Sweden. I think Sochi in the Soviet Union dropped out before the final day. The Japanese brought a massive contingent of people. They had about 600 people there and put on all kinds of displays of music and folk dancing and so on. And some of the other cities did too.
What did Salt Lake do?
And the well, we had a hospitality suite at which we which was again decorated by Pam and her people.
Just a second, please. I'm going to reverse this. Okay.
This was in the hotel where the IOC members were staying, where we stayed too. And this hospitality suite was decorated with spruce and pine trees that we brought in. It had a real Western flavor, and we had a band there playing Western and hillbilly tunes. And a well-stocked bar, of course, and plenty of good things to eat. And the IOC members took advantage of the invitation to come in and chat with us. Of course, we knew most of them already well from their visit to Salt Lake City. They were no strangers to us. And when it came to the vote on the 15th, we all assembled in this meeting hall in the Queen Elizabeth Convention Center, which had been opened by the Queen only several days before. It was brand new, and all of the delegations were assembled in this hall, and after some preliminary replay of some of the videos to sort of settle the audience down. The IOC members made their entrance and lined up on the stage, and then President Samaranch strode in, went to the podium, and put on his glasses and fumbled in his pocket for a little piece of paper, which he then carefully unfolded, peered at, and said, "And the winning city is Nagano." So the Japanese delegation, which was by far the largest, erupted in shouts of banzai. I don't think really banzai, but anyway, there was a lot of noise, and we lost in the final ballot by, I think it was 46 to 42
oh my.
Votes. It was that close. So we were pretty crushed. On the other hand, we felt that after the Atlanta disadvantage to come so close to winning had been an achievement. The following morning, Governor Bangeter and Spence Eccles of First Security Bank and Rural Topham of Utah Power and Light and several others, Ian Cumming of Leucadia International, L-E-U-C-A-D-I-A, and myself, who had been principal supporters of the bid, and of course Tom Welch, who had who was the president of the bid committee, Dave Johnson. We met in a room in the Swallow Hotel and had a post-mortem. And came to the conclusion that we should take a hard look at bidding again, but we weren't going to rush into anything. And we came home and were greeted enthusiastically at the airport here. And we quickly came to the conclusion that the public reaction to our loss had been a positive one, that we had come very close and that there should be support for another bid. One thing I forgot to mention when you asked about what we did in Birmingham, I mentioned the hospitality suite in the hotel, but more importantly, Pam had rented a mansion some distance out of the center of the city, a very nice home owned by a lawyer and his wife.
Maybe you should speak a little bit louder.
Oh, I'm sorry. Owned by a lawyer and his wife. And they rented this house to us, fully furnished, for 2 weeks there, which was the period before, during, and after the International Olympic Committee meeting. And we flew over from Salt Lake City Tom Sieg and his partners, who S-I-E-G, who own a chain of restaurants here in Salt Lake City. We flew them over, and more than 5 tons of food and cooking equipment, and set up this superb restaurant in the home, to which we invited IOC members for lunches and dinners, and we had virtually all of them show up for one occasion or another to be entertained at what became the Salt Lake home in Birmingham during that period.
What a brilliant idea.
That is quite an undertaking, yeah. Pam got a lot of accolades for, you know, the success of organizing that effort. It was really an experience which the delegates, apart from the loss in the final vote, very much enjoyed. The question of bidding again was colored by the fact that in November of 89, a referendum had taken place in Utah asking the people of the state, A, whether they favored hosting the Olympic Winter Games, and B, whether they would favor using a small portion of property tax revenues to finance the construction of the facilities for staging the Winter Games, which we did not already have. Salt Lake, of course, the Salt Lake area has the venues for alpine and Nordic skiing competition, except for jumps, bobsled and luge, and a speed skating oval. And the question to the people was whether they would favor financing the construction of these facilities at an estimated cost of $55 million from property tax revenues. The vote came out 56 to 44 in favor. Now, these facilities were to be constructed irrespectively of whether we won the Winter Games and would be used as a Western United States training facility for winter sports athletes indefinitely. This was an agreement that we made with the USOC. The USOC said, if you commit to doing this, you will not only be our candidate for the 98 games, but also for the 2002 games. That was the deal. So after losing closely in Birmingham, we knew we would again get the nod of the USOC as a result of the commitment already made here. And we thought, this is too good a way to waste. We better just go ahead and do it. The problem was how to finance another bid campaign at a time when the next vote would be 4 years away, and it would be hard to turn public enthusiasm into hard cash to maintain relationships with the IOC, to build on the friendships that had already been established, and to keep Salt Lake fresh in their minds as a candidate for 2002.
Let me ask one thing. The people that you had cultivated, are they the same people? How much change is there in the IOC?
That's a very good question. There's very little change. Until fairly recently, election to the IOC was lifetime. A few years ago, they established a retirement age of 75, but the members then in the IOC were grandfathered.
Mm-hmm.
So it was only the new ones who by attrition came in.
So you would be able to build on what you had done before.
Yeah. Now, some, of course, in that four-year period either naturally reached the end of their lives or this mandatory retirement age.
Mm-hmm.
So we estimate that the turnover from 91 from 1991 to 1995 is of the order of 10, at the most 15%
mm-hmm.
of the total of 92. Varies from 91 to 93.
Mm-hmm. What sort of, roughly, how much did you spend for the Birmingham thing?
For the Birmingham campaign, we spent just under $6 million.
Which you had to raise.
Which we had to raise, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when we...
The assumption is that the community gets that back if they get the games.
Of course,
mm-hmm.
yes. Oh, yes. Because, you know, there's economic benefits and there's cultural benefits, and there's benefits for the young people who get the opportunity
mm-hmm.
to develop a real interest in winter sports and in some instances to actually compete. I've always been very sold on the Olympic Games. I've always,
mm-hmm.
I remember as a boy, I always looked very closely at the results of competition in both summer and winter games. I was always very interested in this.
But there was 44% of the state who didn't want it.
Yeah, but let me tell you, when it comes to an exercise of raising this kind of money here, of tying that to a vote, that's a pretty tough thing to win by any community. I'd like to see that duplicated
mm-hmm.
by any community anywhere else in the world.
That's right.
When your pocketbook is touched to that extent.
Mm-hmm. I guess I should say 56% of the people wanted it.
That's right.
The way to look
yeah.
at it.
Yeah. So, a couple of weeks after the our return from Birmingham, I got together with Spence Eccles and Verl Topham, and the three of us decided that we would get our companies to underwrite at least a nucleus of contributions that would enable continuity in the bidding. And we each committed our companies to subscribe $100,000 per year for the 4 years from 91 to 95, total of $400,000. And then to build on that. But this nucleus permitted a small staff to continue and to function in an office here in Salt Lake. Of course, the office space donated by by another company. But we wanted particularly to keep the continuity of people. Tom Welch had led the bid for the 98 games. He's a very capable guy, ideally suited for winning friends and influencing people. Now, Tom quit his job as general counsel for Smith Foods about a year before the Birmingham vote, and spent full time on the bid on a pro bono basis. and get paid. And then his chief lieutenant was Dave Johnson, who's an outstanding young man, very knowledgeable in the of the winter sports industry, a real can-do guy whom IOC members developed an instant liking to. It was very obvious. So we wanted to keep those two guys working full-time on the bid. And they went to work in this little office and kept Salt Lake in the forefront of the IOC members' minds during the somewhat slow years there of 92, 93, when the 95 vote was still some distance into the future. In October of 91, the governor, Norm Bangida, and the mayor, Palmopoulos, October of 91, that was, established a board for the Olympic Bid Committee, a board of trustees, and they appointed me as the chairman of that board. And the idea was that Tom Welch, as the president of the Bid Committee, would report to the board and observe the policies, the budgets, and the strategies developed by the board. And that's how the bid has been managed since then. Mm-hmm. Tom continues to work without remuneration. The rest of the staff there, and there's a staff of four or five, are compensated. The next big event was the Albeville Winter Olympics in February of 92. A group of us, Tom Welch, Dave Johnson, Pam and I, and several others, went over there, Spence Eccles, Earl Topham. We had maybe 20 people over there. most of us went at our expense. Staff, of course, was paid for. And we spent a week over there before the games began, during which the IOC had its meeting, had a plenary meeting, and we spent time with groups of them and individually, and were able to take quite a number of them skiing. Courchevel being such a large resort, recreational skiing was permitted despite the preparations for the Winter Games, and we had some very, very good days there, making the tour of the Trois Vallées, Courchevel, Méribel, and Les Menuires. I'll spell all that later. The games themselves were, I thought, very successful. There had been a lot of apprehension that the venues were spread so far through the French Alps with windy, narrow, interconnecting roads, making transportation difficult. But I thought they had done a very good job of estimating the traffic they would have to cope with, limiting access essentially to buses and to a few accredited automobiles only. So as we traveled from venue to venue, we didn't run into long delays. It was just that the travel distances themselves were appreciable, and it sometimes took 2 or 3 hours to get to a venue and get back again. But
that would, you'd have comparable problems here, wouldn't you?
No, not at all. This is what sets us totally apart. That Salt Lake will shine, I think, because of the ease of transportation to the various venues. And this is a big factor with IOC members who attend the full duration, 2 weeks of an Olympiad, to say nothing of the week before when they have their committee meetings. And if they have to stand around and spend a long time getting transported from point A to point B, it's a matter of inconvenience. Mm-hmm. And that's just one part of it. The other thing is they, you know, the idea of an Olympiad is to bring people together and to gather as many of them as possible in one place at one time, athletes, spectators, officials, functions that bring people together and promote the idea of Olympic collegiality and Olympic peace and so on, is what the members of the International Olympic Committee value very highly. And we should be able to convince them that we can do a better job of that than any venue, any winter sports venue that has staged Olympiads in the past.
Hmm.
We have all our venues within 30 minutes of easy driving on roads that can handle large volumes of traffic. We'll provide parking lots that'll hold large numbers of vehicles. Stadiums will have large capacities with plenty of parking facilities. So we should absolutely shine from the transportation point of view. That's one of our strongest suites, I think. The most memorable day at Courchevel, perhaps, at Albeville, was the men's downhill at Val d'Isère. It was a beautiful day, not particularly cold, and the race was run on a new course on what they called the Fosse Bellevard, Bellevarde. It was a somewhat technical course for a downhill, but the amazing thing about it was how much of the course you could see from the finish area, where there was room for 40 or 50,000 spectators. Mm-hmm. You know, downhill, men's downhill course has to be pretty close to 1,000 meters vertical drop. And you could see, you could pick up the skier from way up near the top when he still had about 80% of the course to run. And he'd follow him all the way down. Now sure, they had large TVs, large screens there that showed close-ups of the racer right from the moment he left the gate, but at the same time you could also follow him with the naked eye from a considerable distance, of course, and see him work his way down. It was a very successful and memorable day. It gave us a lot of, we learned a lot from what we observed at Albeville. We attended several IOC meetings since then, when the Olympic Museum was opened in Lausanne in June of last year. This was a memorable event. It's a beautiful facility that cost $100 million to build, and you can get lost there for hours reviewing the history of the Olympic Games at the various locations where they've been held. Every year, or the last 2 years, there have been meetings at Monte Carlo. And at the last one, in September, last September, was the meeting at which the winning city for the 2000 Summer Games was selected. And the winner was Sydney by a margin of only 2 votes over Beijing, 45-43. Here again, going right down to the final hour, the clear favorite was Beijing. And Sydney was the surprise winner by virtue of two things. They had worked extremely hard to present themselves as an enthusiastic candidate, and they had put their money where their mouth was, and at the summer sports complex at Homebush, on the shore of Sydney Harbour. They had already spent, I forget the amount of money, but very big money on preparing facilities there at the time of the vote. So it wasn't a matter of saying, like Beijing was saying, hey, by the year 2000 we'll have this, that, and the other done. The Sydney people were able to say, look what we've done already.
Mm-hmm.
Sydney also took very, very meticulous pains to bring environmentalists on side. They had strong support from environmental groups versus Beijing, which has a huge pollution problem right now, and they don't really know how they're going to clean it up. I think one thing that went against Beijing was in their final presentation, which we witnessed. The vice president of China, forget his name, said, look, you can be sure of several things. One is that by the year 2000, we'll have the environment cleaned up in Beijing. Second, we guarantee that we'll have state-of-the-art facilities at all the venues. And the third thing is we guarantee that all the athletes, the coaches, spectators will be freely admitted into the country and will be allowed to leave again. Well, there was a moment's stunned silence and then ironic laughter from all sides. That was a diplomatic gaffe, which
to have to easily, say that.
Yeah, yes. Oh yes, that was a poor thing to have to admit. Now the pace is...
excuse me, didn't you go to a meeting in Kuwait?
Yeah, that was in December. To a meeting of the Olympic Council of Asia. Dave Johnson and I went to attend that, and I gave a presentation on Salt Lake. And we were very generously hosted by Sheikh Ahmad El Sabah, who's the International Olympic Committee member for IOC, for Kuwait, and succeeded his father, who was killed by the Iraqis in front of the palace in the Gulf War. And Sheikh Ahmad was very kind to us. And we had a good reception there, and I thought that the other IOC members from Asia also appreciated the effort we made there. To my amazement, Kuwait did not show any scars of the Gulf War. They'd done a fantastic job of totally rebuilding what had been damaged. We come now to within 16 months of the vote in Budapest in June of 95, when the city to host the 2002 Olympic Winter Games will be selected. And at this time, there are 10 cities bidding.